You could have put together a pretty good record collection back then by paying reasonable attention to the recommendations of writers like Richard Williams and Michael Watts. I did, anyway. In fact, I read every issue of Melody Maker from cover to cover, at least twice over, hungry for everything in it, thus including the jazz section, folk news, the Loon Pants ads at the back, and the enormous classified section that lurks there also, a vast marketplace for jobbing musicians. Did a able accordionist ever find the gig he was looking for? For years, I go on, Melody Maker is just about indispensable. But something's recently changed. In 1972, the ailing New Musical Express is given weeks to improve circulation or face closure. The paper's editor, Alan Smith, and his deputy, Nick Logan, boldly recruit new writers from London's underground press, who bring a new acerbity to its pages, and an irreverence and general liveliness that suddenly makes Melody Maker seem regrettably stuffy, sober, and staid. Its more temperate approach to just about everything makes it seem dull against its rival's colourful outspokenness. There are still plenty of great writers on Melody Maker, I say, but what makes new NME stars like Nick Kent and Charles Shaw Murray stand out, apart from their writing, of course, is that they look so much the part. The picture bylines of Melody Maker staff do little to flatter them. Richard Williams and his frankly scary moustache have both gone by 1974, but long-serving features editor Chris Welsh still beams from Melody Maker's pages like someone who's just won a marrow in a raffle, while assistant editor Mick Watt's picture makes him look frighteningly like the infamous international terrorist Carlos the Jackal. Kent, on the other hand, looks enough like a rock star to pass for one of Roxy Music's itinerant early bass players, and Charlie Murray, with his shades, afro and leather jackets, wouldn't be out of place in a band shot of the MC5. My point, that Melody Maker right now could do with livening up. I go on about this at some length, get quickly and hopelessly worked up, and with a bravado I don't for a moment really feel, sign off the letter with the following message. Melody Maker needs a bullet up the arse. I'm the gun. Pull the trigger. I post the thing before I have second thoughts. A week later, I get a letter from Ray Coleman, along with a totally flabbergasting invitation. Can I come in to Melody Maker headquarters for an interview? Hey, what? How did this happen? Has no one else applied for the job? Come the appointed day, I turn up at Melody Maker's offices in Fleet Street, convinced there's been a mistake that will belatedly be recognised upon my arrival, at which point I fully expect to be sent politely packing, with apologies for whatever misunderstanding has occurred. In the event, I'm ushered into the presence of the fabled Coleman, the editor who's turned Melody Maker into such a sales juggernaut. He's a man in his late 30s, balding with fuzzy sideburns, large, heavy-rimmed glasses, and the reassuring manner of an avuncular oncologist or much-loved family vet, although the jarring colour clash of what he's wearing, a purple suit, bright yellow tie and lime-green shirt, makes him look like the manager of a Miami car wash franchise. He's quite a sight. God knows what he makes of me with my scarves, bracelets, earring and one of my old glam rock jackets with padded shoulders, sequins and zips up the inside of both sleeves. Whatever, he's warm and courteous, and we chat pleasantly about art school and music for around half an hour, with Ray gently prompting sometimes outrageous opinions from me that seem to amuse him. And that's pretty much it. I hadn't been expecting to sit a written exam or anything, but I'm still surprised that Ray hasn't asked me to present so much as a shopping list as evidence that I can actually, you know, write. Instead, he thanks me for dropping in, as if I've just strolled by and popped in to see him on a whim, shows me to the door and says he'll be in touch. 2 weeks later, I still haven't heard from him and presume I've made such a hapless impression that he's simply forgotten me. I can only imagine they've done the sensible thing and given the job to some ingratiating little swot with a taste for bands that wear wizards' capes, which would, of course, left me with no hard feelings whatsoever. Absolutely none. Then, one afternoon at the bookshop, I get a call from someone who says she's Ray's...